from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. San Francisco Mayor London Breed is coming up on the one-year mark of taking office after voters chose her to fill out the rest of Ed Lee's term. This hour, Mayor Breed joins us to talk about issues she inherited, including stubborn homelessness, drugs and mental illness on the streets, and the lack of affordable housing, and the initiatives she started during her first year in office, some of which are facing tough opposition from the Board of Supervisors. Mayor Breed is back on the ballot in November when voters will decide whether to give her a full four-year term. She joins us right after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. My guest this hour is London Breed. Last year, voters narrowly elected the former president of the Board of Supervisors to fill out the term of the late mayor, Ed Lee, after he died suddenly. She's on the ballot again in November, seeking a full four-year term without any serious opposition, at least from my point of view. You may disagree. Mayor London Breed, thanks for coming in on a Monday morning. I know it's not your favorite time of the week, Monday mornings.
Well, Monday is the start of the week. It's the time to get ready for, you know, just dealing with the city challenges. So I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Do you ever really get a weekend as mayor?
I don't necessarily get a whole weekend, but I do try and take some hours within the weekend. This weekend was absolutely incredible. We had the San Francisco Juneteenth Festival. That was amazing. A number of events in the evening times and the North Beach Festival. So great time in San Francisco. Weather was a little bit chillier than it had been, but, you know, it was, I was able to tolerate that because that's the kind of weather I'm
used
like to
that? Moderate.
As a San Franciscan. Yes.
Carl the fog rolled in.
Yes.
I mentioned that you're not really facing any serious opposition. I mean, so I don't think anyone, you have six challengers. I don't think it's probably anyone that most folks have heard of. Do you take that as a sort of endorsement of your first year in office?
I think it's important that regardless of who is challenging me on the ballot, that it's important that I continue to do the work and I continue to, get out there, meet with constituents, hear their concerns, host the town halls and the office hours and all the great things we're doing so that we can take what people care about and implement that at City Hall, regardless of whether or not I'm on the ballot. I think that's important. That's what I would want in an elected official, someone who's always focusing on the issues and doing what they need to do to ensure that, you know, they're the right person for the job. And so that's exactly what I plan to do.
Mayor London Breed is with us for the hour, and I'm going to open up the phone lines. The number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org, or you can reach us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. You going to debate those six people?
I haven't been invited to one just yet, and I hope that I don't get invited to one. I think what's important is to focus on the work, because we have made like a lot of progress with the number of things that we're doing in the city. I mean, we can even start with homelessness. We know that that is a major challenge, but think about it. Last year, there were large tent encampments all over the city. And you still see tents, yes, but you don't see what you did last year. We're changing that. We've helped to get almost 1,400 people off the streets, into shelters, into permanent supportive housing, reconnected with their families in cities all over the country. So we are making progress, and we have this incredible system so that we are able to track things a lot better and to get people the help and the support they need.
Before you came into office, the predecessor, Mark Farrell, was probably a little more aggressive than somebody who was going to be facing the voters might have been in terms of getting encampments off the streets. What's the challenge to keeping those encampments to a minimum?
So part of it is making sure we have places for people to go. And look into the freeway where it was before on DeBose in that particular area. On Caltrain land, we now have 120 new shelter beds where a number of those individuals were able to be housed at. And we're going to be extending those beds by another, I think, 60 or 80 new beds. So I think part of it is making sure that we have places for people to go. And this is why I'm being very aggressive about putting forth 1,000 new shelter beds by 2020. We've already opened 338 new shelter beds. And ultimately, the goal is, you know, if we have a place for you to go, then we need to make sure that people go to where, you know, they can get the help and the services that they need.
When you took office or were about to take office, I remember asking you, what are you going to be judged on? And you said, without hesitation, homelessness. We've saw a report come out from the city, this report that the city controller's office does every 2 years, 53% of people saying it's still the top issue, 75% think it's gotten worse in the last 2 years, and just 8% think it's better. Are they wrong?
Well, I will say for those almost 1,400 people that we helped to get off the streets, that is a difference. But one of the biggest challenges is that we face are really helping people to avoid homelessness in the first place. And so that's really why we are investing $5 million additional revenue into rapid rehousing, as well as helping prevent people from becoming homeless in the first place. So sometimes, for example, if someone loses their job and they can't pay their rent, then these housing subsidies will provide a number of months payment for their rent in order to keep them housed. Because again, it would be much more expensive if they get evicted, and the services and the support that we have to provide and additional services to help them get reemployed. And so I think helping people before they get to that point in the first place is one thing. And also right to counsel, making sure that tenants who face eviction have the kind of support they need, because it could be something as simple as, you know, a few months rent payment, or helping deal with some issue that someone promises not to do again. So I think we have to invest more in making sure that people stay housed. And that's really what's going to go a long way in terms of preventing homelessness in the first place.
You were acting mayor temporarily, then of course you were board president. And so it's not like you didn't have access to good briefings. But now that you're mayor, what have you learned about homelessness that you didn't know?
I think that it's a lot more complex than most people think it is. It's not as simple as we can get someone housed and keep it that way, because it takes a lot of work for those individuals. And I got to tell you, because I had a number of, you know, clients that were on my, you know, personal agenda to get help for, I kind of understood this issue inside and out. And it's why even before I was mayor, I really focused on mental health because of people who are suffering from substance use disorder, the psychosis from substance use, and the schizophrenia and a number of other issues that some of the folks I was trying to work with suffered from, and the difficulty in providing them the support and resources they needed. And so what we need to do, you know, is really invest in a complete change in our mental health system, a very responsible change. I hired a new mental health reform director to help address those challenges with behavioral health, which are a diverse number of challenges. And the goal is invest in more mental health stabilization beds, invest in outpatient treatment, invest in on the ground support for mentally ill individuals. And we've already provided over 100 new mental health stabilization beds and plan to provide 100 more.
As you know, the Board of Supervisors is considering a mental health for all kind of ballot measure for November of next year. It would be paid for by a tax on companies where the CEO is making more than 100 times the average salary. I believe you're opposing that, or you have some reservations about it. Tell me what those reservations are.
So first of all, this plan was created without consulting the Department of Public Health, without talking to any of the health experts or the people who are actively engaged in helping to address this issue.
Is it too late for that?
No, it's definitely not too late for that. And then secondly, I think there's some information, some conflict in terms of what it might cost, because we're talking about, you know, almost $500 million of ongoing services to provide medications, to provide support around the pharmacy. I mean, the list goes on, but let me just be clear. The challenge we have is not necessarily providing supportive service for people who face mental illness. The challenge we have is getting them to commit to the service in the first place. And so part of why I've pushed to get the conservatorship legislation, where we provide a guardian who can help make decisions for someone who can't make decisions for themselves, I push for that legislation because the biggest challenge we have is getting people to commit to the services in the first place. We don't have people standing in line waiting for mental health support. So this is, I'm not certain that this is the right approach, but I'm definitely always open to working with members of the Board of Supervisors to address what we know is one of the most challenging issues we face.
And I believe you're talking about Senator Wiener's legislation on conservatorship, which I believe passed and the governor signed, but it turned out to be much more
narrow.
Limited.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the good news is that Senator Wiener is currently working on a fix to that, which is working its way through the process. And as soon as this current governor signs that legislation, it'll go into effect immediately.
And what impact will that have? Will it affect a larger number of people? Because I think as it is now, it's only like 5 to 10 people.
It will affect a larger number of people. So we're talking about definitely over 50 and possibly 100 based on people that we've identified. And let's just talk about those people, because we're talking about people who are chronically homeless, who suffer from substance use disorder and mental illness. So those three conditions. And, you know, these are people who are cycling in and out of our jails. They're cycling in and out of our hospitals. And I talk about this on a regular basis. Our county jail is being used as a mental health institution. And we're wondering, okay, this person gets locked up. They're held for 72 hours. And then the next day or the day after, they're in the same location with the same condition. And the people of San Francisco are wondering, what are we doing and why aren't we fixing it? And so this is just really one tool, along with so many other things that we need to completely reform this system and address it in the way that we can make an impact. But we are going to need changes to our state policies if we're going to really make a meaningful impact on this issue.
A lot of people want to talk to you. Before I bring in our listeners, let me just ask you, you were supportive of and still are a navigation center down on the Embarcadero. There was a lot of pushback from the South Beach community, some very heated public meetings. The Port Commission ultimately voted to move ahead with that. Were you surprised by the level of opposition, and what did you learn from that?
Well, I will say that the level of opposition was unfortunate, but
why was it unfortunate?
It's unfortunate because it was really very divisive in how it created just a wedge with folks in the city and the folks in the community, and that was of course never my intention, which is why I brought the conversation to the community to be able to have an open and honest conversation and to hear the anger and the frustration, but ultimately, the people of San Francisco elected me to office to address this issue especially. And the only way we're going to get to a better place is if we provide places for people to go. And this new shelter system that we have developed provides 24-hour wraparound supportive services, oversight, and all the things that our shelter should have as a way to not only help people off the streets, but to keep people safe and to keep community safe. And so I just really want this community to give us a chance and to demonstrate what we're able to do. And of course,
but they're suing, aren't they?
Yeah, but also I understand. Let us have a chance to do it. Hold us accountable if we're not doing everything that we said that we would do. But I'm hopeful that we'll get this thing going and we'll prove to them that this could be a great thing for our city.
What's at the heart of their opposition, do you think?
I think what might be at the heart is the unknown. The unknown of what this might bring. There's an assumption that when you have shelters, that there might be problems surrounding those shelters. But I can tell you, the example I give is Dog Patch. The community in the Dog Patch, they were opposed to the shelter, the navigation center in that particular area. There was a lot of community opposition. They agreed to it initially, with certain conditions. And then before the lease even expired, they came to the port and they said, we're okay with you extending it, because they were appreciative of how the city was handling it, and they wanted to be supportive of some real solutions that help people.
Do you feel in retrospect that maybe your office could have done better outreach before those meetings happened? Is there anything you could have done to mitigate some of the anger and the hostility?
I think part of it is we did outreach. We held meetings. I mean, that was the start of the conversation. So going out there, having the meetings, letting people say whatever's on their mind, trying to address their issues. But at the end of the day, there were some people who just didn't want to hear what we had to say.
All right, let's go to the phones. And Laura in San Francisco, I think you have a question about that navigation center. Welcome.
Hi there. Yeah, thank you for having me. First-time caller, but long-time listener. I was really excited that the navigation center on the Embarcadero was passed, and I was wondering, what are the next steps now? I know you touched upon that a little bit, but I'd love to hear more, and I'd like to know also, are there any more centers like it in the works?
Yes, and thank you for your question. The appeal that is being proposed by the residents who oppose the navigation center will be going to the Board of Supervisors next week. So after that process, depending on what the Board of Supervisors do, if they strike down the appeal, that means we can move forward and get going.
Whose district is that? Is that Peskin?
That is Supervisor Haney's
Haney.
District. That's District 6.
And is he supportive of it?
He's supportive of the navigation center. So if depending on what the supervisors do, if they support the appeal, we won't be able to move forward. If they oppose the appeal, then we'll be able to move forward and get it going. There could be other challenges, but in the meantime, we'll move full speed ahead. We do have several other locations that we are working and negotiating with, and before we can make those locations public, we want to make sure that we sign a lease and have an agreement. But I am really excited about those locations, and hopefully we'll be rolling out, you know, at least one or two this summer where people can provide their support for those particular navigation centers. And thank you for your support on this issue.
I asked earlier whether people were wrong in their perception that homelessness had gotten worse in the last 2 years. And in fairness, you've been there only 1 year. But there was a homeless count, a street count that was done that showed that there was, in fact, an increase, not just here, but across California. So what is the problems getting worse? Is that because of the affordability crisis? Is it like, what is it exactly?
I think there's a combination of things. I think, of course, we have not built enough housing. And I think the fact that we are proposing solutions to get more housing built, and then we continue to sadly have people who say they want more housing, they want more affordability, but when the opportunity presents itself to build in certain neighborhoods, people oppose the housing and make it difficult to get it done.
Well, and some of those people are on the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, and I think also it's bureaucracy. It's really like the time it takes. I mean, Francis Scott Key, the old elementary school where in the Sunset, where there's a proposal for 100% affordable teacher housing, an additional 2-year delay because of rezoning of that property for housing.
So it must be incredibly frustrating, because everyone says they want to deal with the homelessness, they want to deal with the affordability crisis, they want more housing. But when it's in their backyard or in their district or in their neighborhood, you know, there is just, and it's not just in San Francisco, but, you know, this is a liberal city that embraces affordable housing like few places do.
Yeah. And the fact is, you know, I grew up here, and I'm really sensitive to the fact that so many of my friends and family members can't afford to live here anymore because we have not done what we should have as it relates to affordable housing. And when I have conversations with people all over the city, especially where, you know, heights and their height limits and other issues in those particular neighborhoods, you know, I ask them, did you raise your kids in San Francisco? Yeah. Do your kids still live here in San Francisco? No, they don't live here in San Francisco. And that's really at the heart of the problem is housing production. That's really where we need to get a lot more aggressive with what we produce so that we don't make the mistakes of the past and the next generation of young people growing up in this city have a fighting chance of being a part of San Francisco's future.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Matt in San Francisco, you're on with San Francisco Mayor London Breed.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I live in Russian Hill in the north side, but I think this is a citywide concern. There are so many vacant storefronts around me. I'm thinking Polk and Van Ness, but I think in the Mission, in the Sunset. For a city with so much wealth, where business seems to be thriving, But yet at the same time, there are so many vacant stores, some of which in my neighborhood have been vacant for 5 or 6 years. What do you think is going on with that? And what can you potentially do about it? Because having all these open, empty spaces doesn't seem to be good for anybody.
Yeah, and I think it's a combination of things. I mean, the fact is, you know, people are shopping online a lot more and getting things through other means, whereas before, so many people really relied on neighborhood serving businesses. And I think that's had a tremendous impact on, you know, small businesses in San Francisco. I also think that the landlords of those small property, those businesses, they want a lot of money. So especially when it comes to lease renewal. So that's been a real challenge. Part of what I proposed in my upcoming budget is an additional $9 million investment for small businesses so that we can help with tenant and facade improvements for those small businesses, provide additional rent subsidies for those small businesses, especially our legacy businesses that have been in business for 30 years, and figuring out more ways to invest in community corridors and also rezoning those spaces so they're not necessarily just used for one purpose. So providing diverse uses in those storefront pop-ups and other things so that we can get more creative with the use of these spaces so that the business owners can generate more money so that they can afford to pay, sadly, the expensive rents that are oftentimes inflicted upon them.
There's been some talk about maybe taxing some of these landlords who leave storefronts vacant for 6 months or more. Would you support that?
Yeah, and I think that's something we should definitely look at because, you know, part of the challenge are, you know, people who have a significant amount of property and are not making it available. I mean, I know in the Fillmore in particular, you know, one of the landlords there, I mean, those storefronts in some instances have been vacant for 20 years. And that is just really not healthy for even the other businesses. And it makes for a challenge for those businesses to be successful. So we're making investments, financial investments, which also includes reducing the fees for small businesses. So they're not paying all these ridiculous, redundant fees in some instances to the city as well. So trying to do our part is going to be critical, but we need a bigger picture strategy around small businesses, and that's something we're looking at and investing in.
Matt, thanks very much for the call. And in that regard, Mayor, in terms of, you mentioned a moment ago that bureaucracy is part of the problem with housing construction. I live in the Mission, not far from here, and there's a storefront on 21st between Bryant and Harrison. And I was walking by one day, and there's a guy in there basically cleaning it out. He wants to put a coffee shop in there. He says he's been waiting. Now, I haven't verified all this, but he said he'd been waiting for a year to get the permits from the city, and that fortunately the landlord has not been charging him rent. That's the only way he could even stick with his plan to put the coffee shop there. So, I mean, I know in some neighborhoods there's actually restrictions on coffee places. I'm not sure that's the case here, but what can the city do to relieve some of the burden? Because time is money,
and,
right?
And I'll tell you that that's a really, he's lucky because most landlords will charge you and you're stuck going through the city process. So I've instructed the director of the Office of Economic and Workforce Development to come up with a long-term plan so that we can address what we know are serious challenges to support small businesses, including the reduction of fees and speeding up the permitting process.
All right. San Francisco Mayor London Breed, she's here for the rest of the hour. If you'd like to join us, give us a ring at 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Or you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Hope you'll stick around. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here with San Francisco Mayor London Breed. And we've got a lot of comments here. I'll read some of them in a moment, but let me give out the phone number again, 866-733-6786. And David writes, I am just not seeing any improvement in the encampment situation. I live in the Mission near Dolores Park. It's a constant problem. Shooting up in public, filth, aggressive behavior from tent dwellers. It's far worse since Mayor Breed and our new supervisor Mandelman took over. Very frustrating. I still see tents up and down Division and Folsom streets. So what good is the Navigation Center if there are still tents everywhere? I mean, you addressed some of that. But, you know, there is a frustration. I think people have maybe long ago reached sort of the end of their compassion, I think. There's like a compassion fatigue almost. And people just want the problem to go away, which, of course, is easier said than done.
Well, it is easier said than done. And as I said, you know, I never said there aren't any tents. I just said that they were a lot more and a lot larger tent encampments that existed in San Francisco for some time now. And we've been able to reduce those considerably. And I do think that, you know, we continue to run into challenges because part of it is we can't force anyone into treatment. We can't force help onto anyone. But what we try to do through our tent encampment resolution team is go out, have the conversations, and try and figure out ways in which we can help people. And we keep going back. So it's not as if we just walk away because we know that the problem continues. And, you know, we are committed to it. We see the number of calls down for feces. We see the number of calls down for needles and a number of other things. And we're not saying it all went away. We're just saying that we are working hard, making the right investments and trying to address the issue. And we will continue to do just that.
All right. Rob in San Francisco, welcome.
Thank you. I keep reading that we have a serious problem with dirty needles out on the streets for, you know, it's a health hazard for people that are trying to clean the streets and everything. And we have what I've read is called a needle exchange program. But the problem is it sounds like there is no actual exchange. In other words, it's more like a needle distribution program. And I understand wanting to keep people safe so they don't get diseases. But why is it that you don't require a needle for a needle? In other words, they have to bring their dirty needles back so they don't end up on the streets in order to get a free needle. It seems like kind of a no-brainer.
Mayor?
Yeah, and I appreciate your question. And the fact is, the goal is, of course, to make sure that we're reducing the spread of diseases. And part of the needle exchange program originally intended to be an exchange, but also meeting people where they are with the understanding that, you know, we can't necessarily completely control the behavior and whether or not someone chooses to do an exchange and return the needles. We have dedicated resources to cleaning up the needles. We've had dedicated resources to having conversations and getting people to commit. You may be familiar with the fact that people who suffer from substance use disorder, especially once they get high, it's not as simple as we're going to convince them to remember and to bring back a needle for the purposes of exchanging. We do want to change behavior. We do want to get them to commit to being a part of the solution. And the conversations are had on a regular basis. Some organizations and some individuals do a better job than others, but we're definitely committed to reducing the number of needles that we see on the streets. And I will tell you that we have. It's not perfect, but with the amount of resources that we've invested, we are seeing a slight difference and a decline in the number of calls to 311 for this particular issue.
What's the status of Ito Jerry Brown, former Governor Jerry Brown, vetoed legislation that would have allowed San Francisco and I think maybe L.A. to do these pilot programs with so-called safe injection sites? I believe that Scott Wiener's legislation is making it through the legislature again, and Gavin Newsom seems to be very receptive to that. You hopeful for that taking place?
I'm really hopeful because I think that, again, people sadly suffer from substance use disorder. And we want to be compassionate about that, but we also want to make sure that we address some of the challenges that come with substance use. And that includes needles and finding needles on the streets, people shooting up publicly, you know, the issues around drug dealing. We have to address those issues. But once someone gets a hold of what they get a hold of, the goal is to have safe injection sites for the purposes of bringing it inside, helping to reduce the number of needles on the street, but more importantly, treatment on demand. Because we want to be available when someone gets to that point and they need help, they have a place to go and we can give them the kind of help and the support that they need right away. Our goal is
that not exist now if somebody asks for treatment?
Well, we have our Department of Public Health workers. They are out there. They do have, you know, a particular drug. Please don't ask me to pronounce it, but it's out there. And
the one that revives people.
We have Narcan if someone is in the process of overdosing, but there's another drug to help get people off of drugs. And so we have that available, the Department of Public Health. They're out there, and they are able to help provide people with treatment, to help transition them into a place where their support, HealthRight 360, Delancey Street, and other programs, you know, they're always made themselves available to us. And so I think that there are options, but we want to make sure that people, that the options are easier to access. And this is an important part of why I'm pushing for safe injection sites.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Another caller from San Francisco. John, welcome.
Yeah, for the love of God, please, Miss Bree, don't give me the usual answers in regards to the traffic in San Francisco. There is 55,000 cars from Ubers and Lyfts. I work and I live in San Francisco. What are you going to do? What are you going to do to solve this problem? And it seems like it's out of control. It takes about an hour and a half to get from Union Square to the Inner Sunset.
John, I'm looking at the notes here. It says you're a cab driver. Is that correct?
I am.
Okay, so you.
Thank you for your comments, John. And I got to tell you, yes, it's a real problem. And as you know, as a taxi cab driver, we don't have a lot of control. The state has a lot of control. And the good news is we have the opportunity to put on the ballot this November a tax for those rideshare companies so that they can also pay their fair share as it relates to some of the challenges with the conditions of our streets, our infrastructure. They have an impact on our infrastructure. But I do think that similar to, you know, taxi cabs, there need to be limits. And so this is really what I'm pushing our state leaders to help us address so that we have more control. We have data that's helping us to understand how many of those vehicles are on the streets, at a time. And we need some sort of controls to limit the number of those vehicles on the streets at any given time. And
it's
that's
crazy
gonna
that
take,
the city has no real power to do anything about that.
I mean, it is the most frustrating thing. People think, okay, we can wave a magic wand, create policy locally, and we can do congestion pricing. We can do all these other things and, you know, force people to pick up and drop off in certain locations. So there are various things that we are trying to do, but that's not going to solve the issue. We need more control on the local level, and we need help from our state officials, which I'm actively engaged with, to try and help us address this issue because this is not sustainable.
Right now, I think the California Public Utilities Commission has control over not only taxi cabs, but also these TNCs, Uber and Lyft.
Yes.
Would you like to see sort of like what's happening with the needle or the safe injection sites have a pilot project for a place like San Francisco where we would take control at least temporarily away from?
I think that because the impacts that they have on major cities, and let's be clear, I'm not suggesting that, you know, we not have them. I think they're a good resource to get people around. But I just think that, you know, it's created, you know, with the construction, with Muni, with all the different modes of transportation, our bicyclists and everyone else, it's just really created an environment that is not sustainable long term. So we need to put some limitations, you know, on what's out there at any given time to move people around, not only more efficiently, but also more safely.
What would you like to see our state, you know, legislators do?
I want our state legislators to give locally us the authority to make decisions similar to what we do in terms of issuing medallions for taxi cabs. I want us to be able to do something very similar with regards to rideshare companies.
I mentioned that report that came out on the controller's office, from the controller's office a few weeks ago, and the lowest grade of all was for transportation, and Muni and the trains, the buses got a C-plus grade. And I know that you've had some very public criticism in recent months of Ed Reskin, the Muni MTA chief, who is now leaving. What are you looking for in a new MTA director?
I'm looking for someone with a vision, someone who's creative, someone who understands like a major transportation network, because it's not just about Muni. It's about how do we move people around San Francisco as efficiently and as safely as possible. How do we get people to choose public transportation over any other mode of transportation in San Francisco? How do we make sure that we have dedicated bike lanes? How do we make sure that we have the right system where people understand the signage and they understand the how the infrastructure works and how everything works in the city, so that no matter where you come from, if you're visiting San Francisco, you can get around easily. If you're trying to get to work on a daily basis or school or anything else of that nature, there is an easier way to move people around. So looking at our system on a citywide level and how it connects with the broader region and our long-term strategy. So I'm looking for a visionary, someone who is an incredible transportation expert who is really going to change the face of San Francisco so that we can have a transportation network that people can be really proud of.
Those are not a dime a dozen, are they?
No.
People that have that kind of expertise. You know, if you think about...
They're out there.
They're out there?
Yes. And we're going to find them.
If you think about what the MTA or Muni was responsible for, say, 10, 20 years ago, it was buses, trains, cable cars. Now they've got all that, plus, as you said, bicycles. They've got Lyft. An Uber to deal with. They've got taxi cabs. They've got bike lanes. They've got electric scooters, all kinds of things. And I'm wondering, do you think perhaps the city should look at splitting up the responsibility, creating a separate transportation agency?
Well, I'm not certain that would be a good idea, because I think all these things work hand in hand. I mean, the fact is, when you look at how many people are using bicycles to get around in this city, just imagine if no one was using a bicycle and how much more difficult it would be, and how those things work together. Because the goal is, we need to make sure they all are working together, that we make sure that different modes of transportation are available and not everyone operating in their own silo. So I think there's a great way to make these things work more efficiently for all San Franciscans.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Another San Franciscan, Lynn, welcome. You're on with Mayor London Breed.
Hi. I've heard some rumblings about a very expensive housing bond that will be voted on this fall. Are we going to have to pay more taxes for that?
Oh, my goodness, Lynn. I am so happy you asked that question. No, this is a $600 million housing bond for middle and low income residents of San Francisco, and it will not raise property taxes, period. I'm really proud of the work that we have done in our city since 2006 to provide a very responsible way through bond financing, so that as we retire more debt, we look at our capacity and what we're able to take on, and we do it in a way to avoid raising property taxes for San Franciscans, which I'm very proud of.
So you're supporting that, obviously.
I'm leading the effort.
Let me ask you about another effort you're leading, and that is the charter amendment to expedite affordable housing construction and housing for teachers by reducing city bureaucracy. There was a big story in the Chronicle yesterday that this is in big trouble at the Board of Supes. I think you're contending that a lot of the problem is the bureaucracy, and this ballot measure, which is a charter amendment, would greenlight projects that meet certain standards, like housing for teachers and staffers for the city, stopping projects for subjective reasons, eliminating lengthy CEQA reviews, the environmental reviews that can hold things up, and even ending public appeals of the planning department. And some of the supervisors, although they say they want more housing, also say that they don't want to take away that right of the public to appeal. What are your thoughts?
So my thoughts are, there are certain height limitations in San Francisco. There are certain laws that exist already. So we're talking about not someone who wants an additional increase in height or someone who wants something outside the scope of the existing laws. What we're saying is, if this project is following the existing codes, following the existing height limitations, doing exactly what is already, you know, within the scope of the law to do, then let's build it, especially if it's 100% affordable housing and if it's teachers' housing. It's like the kinds of things that we need. So this is really what I'm pushing for, to get rid of bureaucracy so that there aren't any delays. And the goal is to speed up production for those particular developments. So there's no need to go through a lengthy review process. There's still permits. There's still things that need to be requested for any affordable housing project in San Francisco. But I just think that the fact that we are willing to hold up important housing because someone doesn't want something to maybe block their view, or they don't necessarily want affordable housing in their neighborhood or what have you, when it fits within the code and, you know, it's not doing anything other than what it's able to do, is not the best way.
So when supervisors like Raphael Mandelman say it would be a mistake to take away that last public right to appeal, you'd say what?
I would say that the challenge that we had is with a lot of the public appeals have a lot to do with, you know, individuals who, you know, in some cases don't want to block their views, individuals sometimes who don't want affordable housing in their neighborhoods, and sometimes organizations who want more benefits for the community. And again, for those particular areas, I just don't think it's a good idea to hold up much needed affordable housing that will serve low and middle income residents and teachers because someone doesn't like it for whatever reason. I mean, why is there a need to go through a lengthy review process to hold up this much needed housing?
I want to ask you a question about the police department and the raid on the home of the freelance journalist, Brian Carmody. He was accused of leaking a police report that was that he obtained after the death of Jeff Adachi that made Adachi look bad. The police obtained a warrant and were able to knock down the door of his home. And you and others were initially supportive of what the police did. But then there was sort of this realization that maybe the police department went too far, that there really is a law protecting journalists that should have been thought about before they went and knocked down his door and took his computer and his files. Where are you on that?
So to be clear, the information that I had received is that the warrant was signed off on by two judges. And so that was the information I had. I wasn't privy to all the details of anything other than that.
And the judges didn't know he was a journalist, though, did they?
Well, I don't know that. So I just can tell you what I know in terms of what happened in this particular case. The reason why I pushed to make sure that we do an independent investigation, because there were some questions that were raised about the fact that he is a journalist. There were some concerns. And this, we don't know if this was handled correctly or incorrectly. And I think that there are some concerns around whether or not that was the case. And so at this time, I'm pushing the department to bring in an independent agency to investigate this, because I do think that we need to restore the public's trust around this particular issue. But I also know that although this, you know, was a very challenging situation and people were really frustrated and concerned, especially journalists, we're going to get it right. We're going to basically investigate, and we're going to make sure that the appropriate policies are in place in the future so that something like this never happens again.
When you say you're pushing for an independent investigation, do you mean pushing the police chief, pushing the police commission?
Who? No, we're looking at an outside agency outside the city and county of San Francisco to help investigate this particular situation.
And you would do that with or without the police chief's support, or is he supporting that?
Well, the chief is very supportive of that because, I mean, again, it's something that has to be done.
Where are you on the police chief in terms of supporting him? Bill Scott was, of course, not your choice. He was there when you got into the mayor's office. Do you feel that?
Well, let's be clear. A lot of people who work for the city as department heads were not my choice. But the fact is, you know, as mayor, you know, the goal is to try and make sure that the city is working, that we're holding all the departments accountable to do a good job. And, you know, this department, in fact, violent crime is down in our city, and I'm really proud of that. 2018 versus 2017, homicides are down 18%. Homicides by firearm are down 37%, and car break-ins are down 17%. And so, you know, we know that there are challenges, And when we look at the numbers and when we look at where we were in 2017 and where we were in 2018 and where we're going in 2019, you know, we've come a long way with this department. And so, you know, there was one mistake here in this particular issue. And so my goal is to continue to move forward and do everything I can to keep our city safe.
The POA was very critical of the chief.
The POA is always critical of everything. Next.
So do you have confidence in this chief, and would you like to see him stick around after the election?
So to be clear, you know, I'm not going to discuss any personnel decisions that I plan to make as mayor. But I will say that I'm proud of the leadership of what has been accomplished through this chief as it relates to the reduction in crime for our city. And that is the most important thing that we address in comparison to some of the challenges we faced in the past.
What I'm guessing that no matter what happens with this case of the police breaking down the door of Brian Carmody, that the department knows how he got those reports. I'm just guessing because they got the computers, they got files. Will there be accountability irrespective of what happens?
So just to be clear, Scott, I can't speculate as to what occurred because I don't know. But I will say that there has to be some sort of accountability here for the person who leaked the report and for the way that the raid was handled. We need to get to the bottom of both of those particular things so that we can restore the public's trust around these particular issues. And that's really ultimately what I care about.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Victor in San Francisco, you're on with Mayor London Breed.
Hi, good morning. I have a question in regards to crime in San Francisco. I drive a lot through the Tenderloin, specifically on Golden Gate Avenue and Hyde Street, and that is a lot of drug selling in that particular corner. And I wonder why the city doesn't enforce, if there's any law in placement. What is your opinion? Why are we not, you know, take kind of more people selling drugs out there?
And thank you for your question. And I will say the fact is there are people who are being arrested for selling drugs. Their drugs and their money is being confiscated. And oftentimes they are booked and then they're released. And there aren't always charges brought against them by the district attorney's office. And so I think that there's a real challenge there. And let me be clear, you know, I think there has to be accountability. But my Office of Economic and Workforce Development, the person who works in that office has consistently gone out into the Tenderloin and have had conversations with people that, you know, are out there committing illegal acts to provide alternatives, because we have alternatives. We have employment opportunities where there are jobs that people can make just as much money. So in addition to that, you know, we are making the arrest, but there unfortunately doesn't appear to be a lot of accountability on the district attorney side.
DA George DeGascon is stepping down. There's an election. I know you've endorsed Susie Loftus for that job. Would you like to see the next DA prosecute those cases?
So what I'd like to see is some level of accountability as it relates to someone who's selling drugs. For example, you get arrested the first time, then it's like, okay, look, if you come back through these doors, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a harsher punishment, and trying to provide, you know, wraparound support, job opportunities, and getting people to commit, you know, to what we propose. And that proposal doesn't necessarily have to mean jail time. It can mean you have to work this job, you have to do these particular things, and if you come through these doors again, then there's a stricter sentencing guideline. So I want to see a comprehensive plan around accountability for people who are dealing drugs, and that can include providing people with an option to work as well.
Getting to the end of the hour, but I want to ask you about an initiative that you and the sheriff announced last week. You want to stop charging inmates in the city jail, the county jail, for phone calls, and also stop making money off of products that they and their family members buy in the store there. This is personal for you, isn't it? You have experience in your own family history with this.
Yeah, and, you know, sadly, my brother and other members of my family, and, you know, I'm used to the collect calls coming in to my grandmother's house and the expense. I mean, back then, there weren't cell phones, and so just imagine, you know, getting a $1,000 phone bill and you live in poverty. How is that going to be paid? So payment plans and phone getting cut off. I mean, the list goes on, but ultimately, I think the issue here for me is around equity. And I think it also is important that when people are incarcerated, despite what they did, that there's a connection to your family member, your loved ones in some capacity, because I think it's important for them to, you know, be encouraged to want to change their lives or to do something different. And what we see in our prison system is there's not only expense as it relates to the calls, and they are very expensive. And you can, you know, basically get a free unlimited phone, you know, nowadays for 30, 40, 50 bucks. But there's also this significant markup for commissary, you know, like whether it's like deodorant, socks, you know, Doritos or something you want to buy while you're there. Like we take the extra markup.
What's the markup?
The markup roughly is usually, I think it's, and don't quote me on this, anywhere between 40 and 60%. And we basically take that money and we invest that money into programs to serve the inmates. And those dollars are mostly paid for by women of color, by the spouses, by the girlfriends, by the mothers, by the grandmothers, who are supporting their loved ones who are going through this process. And so, you know, to me, it's really an equity issue. And I thought it was important that we, you know, change the way we do things to provide hopefully hope for these folks to not, you know, reoffend and become productive members of society.
And it's part of a larger conversation, really, that we're having about the inequities in the system, whether it's traffic fees or towing fees that disproportionately affect low-income folks.
Yeah, and so we were able to be the first in the country to waive fines and fees. So that's like the money that we charge someone once we release them for jail. This is not even the restitution for whatever the crime was, but it's like the ankle monitor or the court fees or all these other things that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this person gets a job and they're trying to do right by, you know, like their family. And then they get, you know, their wage are garnished and then they lose hope. And so this is about trying to correct what I feel is a major inequity in our criminal justice system. And I'm really proud of San Francisco for being a leader in these efforts.
All right. San Francisco Mayor London Breed, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate it. We have a lot more phone calls we didn't get to. I'm sure you'll see them at the next city meeting.
I'm sure.
All right. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.